Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiarz. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Institute for Sustainable Energy and the Frederick S. Pardee Center for the Study of the Longer Range Future, titled District Energy in Cities, Unlocking Efficiency, Sustainability, and Resiliency Through Infrastructure Investment. Our speaker is Rob Thornton, President and CEO of the International District Energy Association. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Institute for Sustainable Energy Associate Professor Dr. Madhu Dutta-Kaler.
Rob got his start in the energy field in 1978 when he was a student of Tufts University, from where he graduated. This is very much, his story began very much like all of you. You're in one of the area universities here, or hopefully at BU in our program, because that's the best, you know. But certainly, you know, it's just a start, and it's your passion that puts you wherever you want to go. During his sophomore summer year, he interned at the Energy Policy Information Institute on Beacon Hill, where he was assigned to research the greenhouse effect. And this was 36 years ago, and at a time when the second oil embargo was having its impact and global CO2 emissions were sort of questionable at best. People were thinking, is it really real? Probably it's nothing, so and so on. So that was sort of the context within which he was operating, and his foresight was so much that he knew that there was something here that needed to be worked on, that needed to be made a difference with. As a student, he had an epiphany, figure that energy efficiency and energy policy in the US were in critical need of improvement. And since that time, has been fortunate to spend his entire career in clean energy, building, developing, financing, and managing private companies in solar, geothermal, and district energy CHP systems. Since 2000, he has served as the president of IDEA, International District Energy Association. There's plenty of literature and really great magazines here, and they're free for the taking after the lecture if you wish to take something home. And where he advocates in that space as the president of IDEA for more efficient, resilient, and sustainable energy solutions for cities, campuses, and communities. Rob is an internationally recognized energy leader. And in his role as an industry advocate, he has briefed presidents, energy secretaries, governors, and so on. And I won't take names right now because the list really goes on, but there are some who are questionable on that list, but we won't go there. We'll just leave it at that. His prior experience includes senior posts at Energy Networks, Inc. in Hartford, Connecticut, Cleveland Energy Resources in Cleveland, and so on. And he continues with his work in so many different aspects all over the world, and most recently in Dubai. Rob is also on our advisory board, and we are working together to come up with a cutting-edge certificate program that's going to shake the world, because it's going to create professionals who are going to go out there and really make a difference in this field. So without much ado, we are very delighted and very, very honored to have Rob Thornton today. Rob.
Thank you very much, Madhu, and it's really a pleasure to be here with all of you. So a little bit about IDEA. We've been around since 1909. We're now in our 107th year. We're a nonprofit trade association. We have about 2,200 members in 26 countries, most in North America, the U.S. and Canada. And these are organizations that own and operate district energy systems. So they produce steam or chilled water at a central plant and distribute it through an underground network of pipes to heat and cool cities, campuses, clusters, etc. So IDEA is really a nonprofit association. So why district energy and what's happening in cities? In 1800, there was only one city on the planet with a population over a million. In 1800, that's not very long ago. Only London had more than a million people living in it. 100 years later, there was only three cities on the planet with over 1 million people. Today, There's 336 cities with over 1 million people. And there's 35 cities with more than 30 million people. So this is where I think the energy challenge is significant. And not very long ago, just under 4 billion people lived in cities. It was 2009, I think, where the fulcrum moved, where more than half the world's population now resides in cities. Ladies and gentlemen, it's accelerating. People want to live in cities. They're economic and cultural engines. By 2030, it'll be 4.9 billion people living in cities. That was the global population 20 years ago. So 15 years from now, 14 years from now, it's like the whole population of the globe is now migrated into cities. By 2050, it'll be 6 billion people living in cities. And herein really lies our challenge. Cities account for about 70% of global energy use and about 50% of greenhouse gas emissions. So, you know, this is where the challenge and opportunity resides. But what's missing from this, in most cities, heating and cooling of buildings, heating and air conditioning is more than half of the energy use. But it's not really on the policy landscape. It's not on the radar screen, the heating and cooling of buildings. It's largely focused on electricity. So let's look at electricity. This is what a typical power plant looks like. It's 100 miles away from the city. It's remote. It was built 50, 60 years ago. And two-thirds of the energy that goes into the plant is lost as waste heat. The power plants in the U.S., the central power stations in the U.S., operate at an efficiency of around 32%, 34%. So literally two-thirds of the fuel that goes into the plant is wasted. Our electricity system, as a result, is really both a cause for challenge, but an opportunity. Right now, again, you know, two-thirds of the energy that's consumed in our power plants is wasted as heat. Here it's called conversion losses, an artful term. But really, the useful energy coming out of our power plants is actually quite small. I don't know, if you owned a pizza shop and you wasted two-thirds of the pizza that you produced, I'm not sure you would stay in business very long. If you think about it, this is really a challenging economic physics problem as well as economic problem. So in the U.S., 36% of the energy consumed is waste heat in power plants. It's equivalent to the useful energy used in industry and buildings. I'm hoping this is stark reality to all of you, that our current electricity system is terribly inefficient. In fact, really, this is where we need to spend some effort, because our electricity system, in large sense, remains inefficient from the time of Eisenhower when the plants were built. Now, when I get to the end, I hope to offer some optimism, but the important thing is we really have an immense challenge facing us. This is a plant local in Somerset, Mass. It's the Brayton Point Power Plant. It was built in 1964, largest coal-fired plant in New England, about 1,600 megawatts. It's been operating for about 50 years, and during that time, dumping most of its heat. In fact, it's had once-through cooling, so what it does is it takes water out of the Taunton River and dumps it into Mount Hope Bay. And this was really the catalyst for the Save the Bay movement. I grew up in Rhode Island, not very far from this plant. I watched it being built. It became online in 1964 when I was, you know, a little kid, still believed in Santa Claus. It is not atypical in our industry. So you'll see here, you know, the water comes in through the river and is dumped into the bay. They waste a lot of heat. In fact, on average, about 37 trillion BTUs per year are dumped into Mount Hope Bay. Now, if you put that heat in a pipe and sold it, it'd be worth about $400 million a year. But for the last 60 years, this plant has really been dumping that heat into the bay, into Mount Hope Bay. Now, there are some rules. The EPA has required this plant to modernize, and they, and in fact, with a recent owner, have invested in compliance, thermal compliance and air emissions. And the prior owner has invested, since 2005, over $1 billion in this plant. So one of the things they did is they built cooling towers at the expense of $570 million. I watched these go up. But the story doesn't get better. This plant, even with the conversion from coal over to natural gas, even with the investment in compliance, is really no longer competitive in the electric market. And the capacity factor, which is really their ability to sell electricity, has continually dropped. So the prior owners ended up writing this plant down by over $870 million. And then they sold it. And the current owners thought they could make a go of it. But the truth is, they can't. It's now slated to close next year. So that's not good for the local economy. And some might argue, well, it's, you know, better for the environment. But what's missing is that since 2011, instead of wasting the heat into the bay, they've been wasting it into the sky. Now, there's another way to do that. It's called combined heat and power. You put the heat in a pipe, and you use it to heat cities or communities or people near you. And this is not anything new. In fact, it's been in operation for 120 years. And there's a country that really has invested dramatically in combined heat and power. And ultimately, what you end up with is efficiencies of 75, 80, 85. Some, even 90% of the fuel that goes in comes out as useful energy. You can double or triple the efficiency of your power plants by moving to combined heat and power. Now, that might also require you not to have these big, remote, large stations 100 miles from the cities. Make them smaller, make them closer. But we have the technology, ladies and gentlemen, and it's at work right now. And combined heat and power is a very vital tool to moving our industry and our economy forward. So this isn't, you know, a new technology 30 years away. In Copenhagen, in the first oil embargo in 1970, they experienced a dramatic economic shock. And they decided soon thereafter that if you're going to make power in Denmark, you have to use the heat. You have to sell the heat. And over time, they built combined heat and power and heat networks all across their city. Today, 98% of the buildings in Copenhagen are on district heating. And you know, every municipality wants a CHP. They want a plant in their backyard, in their neighborhood, because of the economic value of it. So it's not in my backyard, it's yes in my backyard. But there's good news. I think we are right now here in the U.S. in the midst of a paradigm shift from our grandfather's grid to what we're going to need in the future, where district energy plants, which were really invented by Thomas Edison in 1880 in New York City, where he made power and heat in order to make a profit, he had to sell the heat too. So again, this is nothing new. But if we move our power plants and actually generate heat and power, not just heat, in our cities, we have an opportunity to do like Denmark and get to efficiencies that are much, you know, I think more economically sustainable, much more environmentally friendly. Make our electricity grid, dramatically more efficient. So that was the story of one plant in Somerset, Mass., about 30, 45 miles away. Here's the plant a little closer. It's Kendall Station. It's on the Charles River, very close to MIT, right? Really right in Kendall Square. You can see it from the river. This is a 256 megawatt plant, smaller, obviously, than Brayton Point, but historically has been an electricity only, also dumping their heat in the Charles River. I mean, you'll know. I mean, basically, power plants consume a lot of water. They produce a lot of heat. You've got to do something with it. Often, you'll see them on bodies of water. But it really wasn't a CHP plant until it was acquired by a new owner, and they've made a significant investment in this plant. Veolia operates the district steam system here in Boston, as well as the steam network in Cambridge. And so they have a fairly robust market all over Boston. You know, we're here. The Kendall Station is there. So I think over 200 customers, a fairly robust network. So they purchased this plant, and they made an investment in the plant as well as reconfiguring the plant. And they built a pipeline from Cambridge across the Kenmore Viaduct. So instead of dumping the heat in the Charles River, they put it in a pipe, and they bring it to Boston, to customers in Boston. Novel idea. Not an insignificant investment. Overall, $121 million. But ladies and gentlemen, very good jobs. Welding pipe, installing plant. These are good union labor infrastructure jobs, and we want to see hundreds more of them happen in the next decade. So a significant investment in this power plant. But the dividend is on the environment. This plant now displaces 475,000 tons of carbon per year, or about 6% of the Boston CO2 budget. That's equivalent to taking 800,000 cars off the road. And to have the same environmental output, you'd need 600 football fields of PV. Now, I don't know about you, but 600 football fields of PV, I'm not sure that's going to happen in Boston. And the point there is energy intensity in cities is also a challenge. Cities have a different energy appetite. But we can achieve those outcomes that I think many of you are interested in and want to see happen with technologies like this, with investments like this that aren't, you know, they're not far off. They really are available to us. And so we're very interested in future-proofing a more resilient city. We're going to talk a little bit about resiliency. But the point I want to make here is that when you have a thermal grid and the scale, integrating the heating and cooling loads of dozens or hundreds or thousands of customers, now you have an economy of scale where you can do something like this, where you can invest in a central plant and use fuels like biomass or river water or surplus heat from the steel mill. So the scale of district energy enables investment that make environmental and economic sense. That's an important point. Now, district energy is nothing new in the U.S. There's over 800 operating systems in the U.S. A few dozen here in the Boston area. Bob Manning is from Harvard. He's joining us. He operates a large steam and chill water system on the Harvard campus. And they're doing great things over there. You know, the challenge for our industry is that we're largely underground. You know, you don't see us. But we're quite ubiquitous. And the industry's been growing. We're averaging, and this is in terms of customers added per year, we're averaging about 37 million square feet of customer growth per year, with schools and hospitals, our campuses are growing, commercial office buildings downtown. The industry is actually quite vibrant and active. And what's driving that? What's driving growth in our industry? This is not a surprise to many of you. We really are now living in where extreme weather has become the norm. And the frequency of extreme weather is now an issue for people that own and operate buildings. The other challenge, of course, is climate change related and drought. And we are living through, you know, I think, very challenging environmental realities in California. Conversely, we've had the polar vortex a couple of winters ago. Many of you who are navigating the streets of Boston, I think you can remember when it was, you know, sub-zero for an extended period of time. These extremes are now becoming the norm. And the result, insurers are looking at the impact of weather and climate in terms of risk, in terms of loss. And the frequency and scale of these losses is now not lost on the people that are driving economic decisions. The frequency is growing. I want the ability to maintain service, reliability, energy supply to my community in the event of a storm, in the growing frequency of a storm. And now, so what's happening is mayors are saying, I want this energy efficiency and I want this resiliency. And I want to be prepared for the next, heaven help us, Sandy. I want to be able to have a power plant that allows me to have a solar farm nearby and integrate that and work in conjunction with that. I want to be able to enable the more solar to occur, more intermittent renewables to occur. Now, you all understand that solar, you know, has wonderful attributes, but also is intermittent. It's not scheduled. You can't really rely on it. And as a result, you have to have capacity to interact with it. And as we've had 60 gigawatts of coal plants come offline in the last 4 years in the U.S., that's impacting tax bases, and mayors want to replace that with local generating assets. Mayors in the U.S. want to look more like Denmark. They want power plants in their communities. And if they have a local source of energy, like biomass or waste wood or, you know, something that's within the sort of farm-to-table notion, and they can use that and keep the energy dollars recirculating in the local economy, they absolutely want that. And you can achieve that with district energy. And let's face it, people want to have lower carbon solutions. They want clean energy, reliable and resilient, because that allows them to compete and attract economic development. And it used to be, in my lifetime, it used to be that the metric for economic competition was, what's the price of your power? You know, so we saw manufacturing migrate to the south, lower cost coal-fired, you know, power plants. Today, that's no longer the only question. What's the price of power? What's the source of power? How clean is it? How resilient is it? What can you do for me in the event of extreme weather? People are thinking about the risk, and they also want to know the carbon intensity. It's no longer how cheap is it. There's a lot of other attributes that CEOs, university presidents, mayors, economic development officials are now considering. And I think therein lies our challenge. And the good news about all of this is it actually does reduce carbon emissions. You get all these other benefits, efficiency, resiliency, economic development, and you reduce carbon at the same time by displacing downstream combustion of fuel. Now, again, back to the grid. So when you have a district energy grid in your community and you have this underground piping network, you now have a market for thermal energy. By consolidating these users, you now have the scale that enables you to make investments. And you get fuel flexibility. If you're a city planner and you're responsible for the future of your city, you now have to deal with some frankly challenging issues. You're going to have different objectives. There'll be a lot of different actors in the mix. You've got to do some assessment, come up with targets. And if you're planners, this is sort of, I think, familiar nomenclature. And cities have very mature district energy systems. In New York City, for instance, in Manhattan, Warsaw, Eastern Europe, there's existing district energy systems throughout. Some of those are in need of renewal. And then we have cities that are expanding, where district energy is really driving the growth in those cities. And some are new. These new cities, and I'll show you in a minute what's happening in Dubai and Abu Dhabi, these new cities that have sort of popped up out of the desert and are deploying district energy. So if you want to make district energy happen, this is not for the faint of heart. It's challenging. I've done it 3 times in cities. It is a Sisyphean task. And you have to involve a lot of different actors. So it's city government, planners, regulators, the local utility, who might view you as a threat. Architects, engineers, people that own and operate buildings, they want to make sure that you're competitive, viable, and long-term. So there's a lot of questions that one needs to answer. What will this look like? How big will it be? Who will be the customers? How do we build it? What's the cost? So when we think about district energy, it's a little bit like trying to land a plane. You start at, 20,000 feet, and you look down, and as you get closer, things come more into view. And there's a process. You start with, okay, what are we thinking about? Where's the data? What does this look like? How do we define this project? Where is it likely to make sense economically, technology? And then there's a process of doing appraisals and iterations. So, rarely does it happen where someone says, I have a great idea, let's build a district energy system, it's all done. This can take, believe me, there is a career in doing this, and I'm here to tell you. And it can be a career in just one city. But there's a process. Paris, for instance, has one of the largest district energy systems in the world. And they use the Seine River to air condition the Louvre. You probably weren't aware of that. But Paris, which is frankly one of the world's, I think, greatest cities, actually has one of the world's greatest district energy systems. And they actually use trash, garbage, as their fuel source. So instead of dumping it in a landfill, they make useful energy with it. Two birds, one stone. But the buildings in Paris, if you've ever been, really have different energy appetites. A hotel is different than an office building, is different than an arena, is different than a museum. And you have to know what your building stock is and what it's going to look like to really understand what the energy consumption of that city is. Yeah, so, and why have an energy strategy in your city? Look, to be honest, in my career, this is a new field, energy planning in cities. It's brand new. And historically, energy was left to the local utility to solve the problems. The local utility owned and operated with a franchise to make electricity and deliver it, natural gas. And that's really, and they, operated in conjunction with the city, but they were responsible for it. They made the decisions. Now, mayors want district energy, CHP, Princeton. And cities are becoming more active. Like, well, that's all well and good, Mr. Utility, but I want carbon reduction. I want to reduce air pollution. I want to reduce our reliance on fossil fuels. I want carbon to go down. I want predictable energy rates. I want to use local energy supply. I don't want coal from Kentucky or gas from Pennsylvania. I want renewable energies. I want to be able to integrate renewables. And I need an energy system that can stand up to the next Sandy. And so what's happened is mayors are recognizing, wow, we need what Princeton has. We need an asset like this. And it's not just existing cities. But to be honest, I said early, heating and cooling is not on the radar screen. It is not policy. It's not, frankly, considered. It's only recently where this is becoming a factor. Now, half the energy consumed in the city is for heating and cooling, yet has been overlooked. Now, you can kind of appreciate that when we have an electric system where we've been wasting two-thirds of the energy, right? So there's an awakening that's happening in cities, and I'm telling you, this is going to be your challenge. This is the opportunity coming for all of you, is to influence this transition, to drive this faster and further. And it's going to be a requirement, I think, and cities are going to want your intelligence and passion and commitment and interest to drive this process. Now, what happened in new cities like Abu Dhabi and Dubai, where they don't actually have the electric grid to support all this new development, they decided, well, we can't build all these new buildings and hang them on the wires. We don't really want to put them on the electric utility because we neither have the capacity nor the wires to support it. And they implemented a strategy to develop district cooling. And it's become very critical to their planning. And so, that's driving it. In Vancouver is arguably one of the most beautiful cities in North America. Raise your hand if you've been to Vancouver. Yeah, it's growing, challenging, expensive, but frankly, focused on implementing district energy. And as their city builds, and there's a lot of investment in residential building stock, they're putting in place zoning and incentive where if your building is designed to be connected to district energy, they'll actually give you an additional floor. So they'll provide an incentive as a developer, a FAR ratio, so that you actually build your building to use district energy, even if it's not present and available in your backyard. The World Bank has been very involved in trying to repurpose and improve the district energy systems in Eastern Europe, where they really don't have metering, they don't have best business practice, and is requiring some renewal. And that's very much underway. And these cities are actively involved. And in China, you know, China is dealing with choking air pollution. You've seen it. You know, the air quality in Beijing is 10 times worse than the smoking lounge at an airport. At times, not all the time. But they have a serious coal combustion emissions particulate issue. And what they're doing is building vast district energy systems. In fact, we hosted a group, Bob, at Harvard from Beijing. They're going to build a district heating supply that dwarfs Copenhagen. They're going to be bringing heat from outside of Beijing into the city. A massive investment. I think they were talking about $5 billion of investment in district heating in China as an environmental strategy. And so now cities are dealing with, okay, how do we catalyze this? How do we drive it? And they use zoning. They use incentives. They use carrot and stick. And this is really all laid out in the District Energy and Cities Initiative. So, you know, these slides, again, will be available to all of you. But we're now, I think, moving into an era of integrated energy planning for cities. This is where I believe you can make a future. I believe you can make a difference. I believe there's opportunity in this realm. And it does involve sort of the arcane blocking and tackling of building codes and some of the more mundane attributes. But cities are looking for help in this direction. Vancouver is using zoning. In Singapore, like Dubai, they wanted a district cooling system, and they said, in this zone of Singapore, which is developing, if you build a building, you must connect to the district cooling system. Now, that can happen in Singapore. All politics aside, you know, in some economies, mandates work. They don't work so well in the U.S., to be honest. And there's other ways to get there, but in Singapore, they have basically the stick and didn't need the carrot. But this is now one of the largest and critical district cooling systems in the world. Tokyo, we just hosted a group from Japan. Was it earlier this week? Was it just Tuesday? And Japan is facing a dramatic challenge, importing all of their energy, decommissioning nuclear, really trying to solve these unique problems. And they're implementing an incentive for district energy-ready buildings. They want developers to build their buildings ready to connect. So that means it's hydronic, not just moving air, that they can use water in heating and air conditioning. And they've set aside some land for these, and they're going to build these district networks. And in fact, in Tokyo, they've said, if you're doing a development more than 50,000 square meters, you must have an energy plan. Not unlike Denmark, where you must use district energy. Because in Japan, you know, where we pay $4 for a unit of natural gas, they're currently paying $17. So if you're paying $17 for something, you're going to want 80 or 90% of it to be available to you, not 30%. If it's 4%, we can live with 30% efficiency. But in Japan, not unlike Denmark, the price really does drive the efficiency. And London has, I think, done a tremendous job. If you're looking for a case study, the federal government in the UK has really embraced district energy, recovering heat from their power plants, doing the Kendal Station all around London, investing in heat networks. And I think the federal government has invested in the order of $12 million US in this program. It's now attracting, $1.6 billion of private capital investment. So the government sets the table for district energy to occur by creating markets and opportunities and galvanizing, reducing the risk for private investors to come in and build these assets. And in the UK, even with Brexit, even with the transition, they continue on this path. And I think we're going to see great things out of London. So cities are now wrestling with, do they really have authority to do this? And they haven't really had it. They're really trying to exercise more authority in this regard. And we see it in Vancouver and frankly, you know, a lot of cities. Boston is, I think, progressive in this regard. And they have been studying both the market for district energy and the potential deployment for microgrids. So again, it's a combination of carrot and stick. Let me jump through that. Now, one of the things that really, you know, this is a term I hope you will pay attention to, energy mapping. If you don't know where the energy is, how can you use it? And so what's happened is you basically do this mapping exercise to understand, are there sources of energy, like a, you know, a power plant or a steel mill that's dumping heat that maybe you could use and sell, right? So cities are undergoing this energy mapping effort. And it's, again, a stakeholder process. If you're in the planning arena, you know, this will be familiar territory for you. And there's steps to doing this. So the energy mapping is, again, sort of landing the plane, looking at a high level, seeing are there sources and uses of energy already in your city, collecting the data. And there is a challenge in the data, because largely it's held by the local utilities. It's in their metering. And getting access to that is not always easy and can require, you know, a sort of a city. Now, Boston is implementing, much like New York did, basically an energy utilization index. Every building over a certain size must report to the city what their energy consumption was. So that makes public the energy appetite of buildings. Now, in New York, it's become very important, you know, much like LEED and having a, you know, silver or platinum building. This takes it one step further, where you're actually showing your cholesterol and your BMI and your, you know, your efficiency. And so tenants can look and see, well, is this a healthy building or not? And they're scoring against each other. But that data, until it's available publicly, it's not so easy to map. But this, again, is an area where I think persistence and public support will drive it. And, you know, you do different mapping for different cities. If it's a new city like Dubai, you know, basically you're looking at a, you know, green field or brown field or, no, tan field. If it's an expanding city, you know, and it's going through renewal and, you know, sort of a turnover, that's another kind of, you know, mapping effort. Refurbishment and then consolidated cities. And so when you get to the blocking and tackling of doing a district energy plan or, you know, moving from mapping into actually implementing this, you know, there are some policies that I think have become accepted. Tariff, regulation, franchising, you know, really all the requirements that go into enabling an operating business to occur and to flourish. So I don't want to get, I'm in the weeds, but, you know, I wanted to acquaint you with what's involved in making a city maybe more able to drive its own energy future. And mapping is very much at the bottom of it. And like London, you know, if you can find waste heat like Kendall Station and get a twofer, get an environmental benefit by no longer overheating a river and using that heat to displace gas that's being consumed in boilers and buildings, man, that's a really smart thing to do. It's really smart, and it's possible. But it requires intelligence and effort and some mapping. And it's not simple. Putting pipe in the ground is not for the faint of heart. It, in fact, can be ridiculously capital intensive, especially in an urban center. And that requires that you have a density of users, that you know where the pipe is going, that you can navigate that, you have talented people, and that you have enough market to justify the investment in the infrastructure. You know, you don't build it and then hope they come, frankly. You know, it really does require both some risk and some staying power. And I won't get into the cost. It's probably self-evident that, you know, doing it in cities is more difficult than in a green field. But one of the things that IDA, we've come up with, is a screening tool. And I won't spend a lot of time on this, but when you're trying to land the plane and you're at 30,000 feet, you know, you're really trying to make sense of, okay, where do we put this down? And you need to be able to sort of do some evaluation and maybe and look at a couple of different things. And so we've come up with a tool where you can collect the data, the energy appetites of buildings, understand what those buildings, you know, need in terms of, obviously, a hotel has a different energy appetite than an office building, than an arena, than a stadium, you know, an event load. You have to understand not only how much they use, but when they use it, because that really does matter in terms of the efficiency of your plant. So you have to look at the building profiles. Not only what are the buildings and where are they, but what do they do with the energy that they consume? And you know, we have some models that get you there. And then you have to sort of map, when are these demands going to occur? A hotel is going to be early in the morning and then later in the afternoon. And, you know, you have to sort of get a sense of this and integrate all of that into your plan. And you don't do a whole city at once. You know, you might do a Kendall Square and then another area over here. And then ultimately you can interconnect them. You don't do the whole city. Nodes are really how you get started. Anchor loads are what you need. A conversion of a big warehouse into condos. An arena or new stadium that's being built. You know, that becomes your anchor load. An existing convention center in a city that's about to be retooled for the next 50 years and needs to replace its heating and cooling plant. You know, that can become your anchor load. And so we've developed a screening tool that really lets us, you know, bring the plane down to 10,000 feet, look at the city, and then evaluate the difference between every building doing it themselves, putting in their own chillers, cooling towers, gas boilers, heat pumps. Buildings have plenty of opportunity. They can heat and cool their building a myriad of different ways. They don't need district energy to do it. They have a range of choices. But when you're trying to develop a district energy system, it's like a three-level chessboard. You know, one level is the built environment. Who are the customers? Where are the customers? How are they going to occupy? Is this a new city where the buildings are new and being occupied or existing? Where do we run the pipe? How do we connect them? The next level, who are we competing with? What's the price of power in our region? How available is gas? Will the utility be a partner or, you know, treat us not so friendly? Are there standby charges on the electricity grid? What's the environment, the economic utility environment in which we'll be operating? And then finally, the economics. You know, will this make economic sense? Can we generate a rate of return? Can it be a sustainable economic investment? And what will be the construction costs and the operating costs? So doing district energy is literally a three-level chessboard. And each of them need to make sense. Some will be stronger than others. And that's really what our model, you know, tries to achieve, is to give planners this inputs with some reasonable outputs, and this is order of magnitude. It's not really an output that you can bring to the bank and say, here's my business plan, I need $50 million. Now you could do, but they'll send you on your way. But the model, you know, again, you need to know, where is this, what's the climate, how do we look at these things? The model will compare every building doing it themselves, district energy, just heating and cooling, cogeneration, you know, combined heat and power, or even connecting to an existing district energy system. And so we find ourselves with the screening tool in this iteration. We're bringing it down. Okay, let's modify the price of natural gas. Maybe it's not $4 for the next 20 years. Maybe it's $5. Oh, it looks like our capital costs are going to be higher. Right, so you can do sensitivity analysis that where you can vary the inputs. And really, it's a combination of capital expense. What does it cost us to build this asset? And when do we invest it over time? Because, again, you don't build one of these assets in 1 year. It can take, you know, 3 years of construction, 2 years of planning, and then another 5 or 10 years of building out the network. So you have to plan that capital. And then what will be our operating expenses? And so what this model does, it helps us look at the energy appetite of the buildings. It overlays their load profiles. It aggregates them so we can kind of see when their needs are going to occur. This is, again, I think more detail for the engineering, you know, people then more of an engineering focus. You might, you know, find this maybe more interesting. But ultimately, you need to understand this is not just energy demand, it's revenue. And what form of revenue is available, you know, to this asset? And ultimately, you know, you kind of have to do some assessments of what are the buildings, who will be the customers, how big will they be, when will they occupy? You know, when it's a new development, let's say, the building gets built, it's not 100% occupied the first year. It might take 3 years for it to fully occupy. And so the energy appetite is also going to change over 3 years. You have to consider that in your economic model. And ultimately, what the tool helps you do is vary some of these inputs, like escalation, occupancy, and see where is the risk. Does this make economic sense? So it gives you guidance as to, you know, does it make, is it financeable, and will someone step forward to make the investment? Again, it's really to help you understand in your city, no, it really doesn't work. There's not enough customers. It's too disparate. The lead time is too far. The uncertainty is too great. Or, well, you know, it might work. Let's vary a few more things. Let's invest more in an engineering study. Let's invest more in understanding where the risk is. And then, you know, rarely do you get like a full green, let's go. But again, this tool kind of helps you do it. And this is really work that we did in Pittsburgh for a master planning site that was once occupied by an arena and now is slated for master development. And so, you know, for the economics, we were talking earlier about the economics, ultimately it gives you a net present value of, you know, of some alternatives, and that becomes really the basis of your business plan. And because ultimately, you know, someone needs to make the investment. And finally, let me conclude. I was in Paris this time last year for the COP21 meeting, where 197 countries signed on. You know, they said, we're going to do it this time. I was in Copenhagen 10 years ago, or 2009, where it didn't happen. And in the end, we were all, I think, crestfallen. But this time, in fact, you know, the global community came together, and this alone won't solve the problem. You know that. It basically says that, you know, really the world is committed to maintaining a target, you know, global warming limit, 2C. And really what it is, it's the wealthy countries, the US, Canada, others, investing in supporting the new emerging economies around the world. The good news is just this past week, 73 countries have ratified, and the trigger was over 55% of the emissions in the aggregate needed to approve it. That has now happened. It is now in force. But my view is, nations talk, cities act. Cities are really moving on this. And I was in Paris City Hall, and there were over 400 mayors there. And you know what? The mayor of Paris, Mike Bloomberg, the mayor of New York, mayors have district energy, and they appreciate it, and they get it. And they actually want to make district energy happen. So my money is on the mayors. My challenge to you is get involved in your city. I mean, you know, the global issues are critical, and we need strong voices. But where the game is, it's in the cities. And that's where the change will happen, because it has to happen. Cities are responsible to their citizens. They live through Sandy. They need resilient, sustainable infrastructure. And really, your opportunity, your challenge, is to make this happen in cities. And I think you'll find a receptive, committed, engaged audience. And I want to leave you with this final thought. It's really up to you. It's really up to you. And we can do it. So thank you very much for all your attention.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You just heard a lecture by Rob Thornton, President and CEO of the International District Energy Association. His lecture was titled District Energy in Cities, Unlocking Efficiency, Sustainability, and Resiliency Through Infrastructure Investment, and was presented by the Boston University Institute for Sustainable Energy and the Frederick S. Pardee Center for the Study of the Longer Range Future. Tonight's moderator was Institute for Sustainable Energy Associate Professor Dr. Madhu Dutta-Kaler. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Jeff Turton. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Jack Lepiars. Thanks for joining us.